Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast.
Today I have Guy Smith Ferrier. He is an internationalization software architect located in the UK, and he was instrumental in helping me twice now with setting up tours of user groups in the UK, and he is generally a swell guy. How are you, Guy?
That's very kind, Jesse. I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I am very, very well. It's been a while since we've seen each other, but it's good to talk
to you. Yeah, indeed, a regular visitor to the UK now.
I'm working on it, yes. That's my goal.
We'll have you saying, call blimey governor any moment now.
That sounds good to me. I did this last time manage to say cheers to someone.
You did, yes. We'll get you swearing in English soon.
Oh, well, that's the topic for today, then. We should talk about what swear words are in English. I did learn that cheers means not only goodbye, but also thank you, depending on context.
It's great, isn't it? And we all know the difference, but it's a closely kept secret. We don't tell anyone.
I appreciate that. So I wanted to talk to you about internationalization. I wanted to talk to you about user groups. Let's start with internationalization. That's your...
What a great subject to talk about.
Now, you have at times disparaged this subject as something that only you are interested in, but I disagree. I think that there are a lot of folks who are very interested in thinking about how to internationalize and, more importantly, how to set up their programs so that they can be internationalized.
I do find this subject absolutely fascinating. It's not only a software engineering problem that's wonderful to try and solve. The myriad of differences there are throughout the world. What I find fascinating about this is every single thing that we think we know is true is wrong. The world's a big place in this respect, and when you move from one culture to another, you discover all the stuff that you've written that really isn't going to work. So I find that fascinating. I'm continually shocked by how many applications are web applications, and therefore, unless they're on an intranet, they're global by their nature, yet they're monolingual. And that's a fairly astonishing thing, given the lost opportunity in the markets. So, yeah, I do find this a very interesting subject. And I think with each new user interface Microsoft comes up with, there's new localization issues. So when we've had Windows Forms and ASP.NET Web Forms for ages, and the localization issues for each of those is separate and distinct. But every 2 years, Microsoft invents a new UI technology. So we get WPF, and we get Silverlight, and then we get ASP.NET MVC, and we get Windows Mobile, and now Windows 8 Store apps. And the localization issues for each and every UI platform is fairly unique. They often get solved in similar ways, but each team doesn't seem, you might have heard this before, each team doesn't seem to talk to the other teams that have come before them.
What a concept. It sounds like the definition of Microsoft. Microsoft, we don't talk to each other.
So I find those problems interesting. I think perhaps for me the most fascinating part is solving globalization problems. And sorry, let me go back a step with definition. So there are these three words: globalization, localization, and internationalization. And everyone's got their own interpretation. They're all used, but many people use them interchangeably, and they're not. They're not interchangeable. They don't mean the same thing. Sadly, we live in a world where Microsoft transposed the meaning of globalization and internationalization about 1997, something like that. And they swapped them around, which really doesn't help, because the rest of the industry is still using the terms as they were before Microsoft swapped them. But unfortunately for us, the .NET framework is based upon the things like system.globalization. And there's a specific interpretation of that. So just to be clear, and stop me waffling for a moment here, given that I live in the Microsoft world and the .NET world, globalization is the adaptation of a program so that there are no cultural preconceptions in it, and that the classic cultural preconception that everyone is aware of is your date format. In the UK, we format our dates one way. In the US, you format them another. And pretty much every country in the world seems to go, let's invent some unique way of formatting our dates.
So just to be clear, in the US, we format our dates when we're not spelling it out. We will format our dates month, date, year. So February 3rd will be 2/3. But yes. In the UK, that would be March 2nd.
Absolutely. So we know 9/11 is September 11th, but obviously for us it would be the 9th of November.
Right, which is why I think they did Armistice Day on the 11th of November, just to solve that problem.
So I find the globalization issue is absolutely fascinating, because the .NET framework has had support for system.globalization since 1.0. And at that moment in time, I thought it did a great job. It did a really good job of solving problems in a way that most languages hadn't solved them before. And that was a great step forwards. Unfortunately, for me, in the last 10 years, it really didn't move forwards. The globalization support in the .NET framework and in the Windows operating system moved in terms of the number of fonts supported, the number of calendars, the number of keyboards, and the maintenance of the vast maintenance of the culture data for cultures all around the world. So with each new version of Windows, we get a new list of cultures supported, and all that data certainly kept moving forwards. But for me, one of my disappointments in this world is I feel that we fell behind. The rest of the industry that does not use the .NET framework also needed to solve all of these problems. And they solved them shortly after the release of .NET 1.0 using something called CLDR, the Common Locale Data Repository, which is their answer to system.globalization namespace and the huge number of cultures which come with the operating system. In that intervening period, I think the scope of the support that we have stood still, and the scope of CLDR grew and grew, to which the rest of the industry and the people using CLDR is quite significant. IBM, Google, Amazon, Apple, the major players are all using CLDR. They have access to solutions for problems which we, without CLDR, need to hand grow. And that's somewhat frustrating. So if we take, for example, postal codes. So anyone who writes an application, let's say you write an application in the US and you need to validate zip codes. So you go on to regexlib.com and you Google zip codes. You get your regular expression, and then you just paste that into your application and go, job done, we're sorted. And then you go, oh, well, we need to support the UK. So you go back to regexlib.com and you go search on UK postcodes or Canadian postcodes. And then each time you take a regular expression and you go, right, well, let's do a different page for the UK. And that's a law of diminishing returns, because it really runs out rapidly. So what we want is a library of postal code regexes, where we can just say, give me the regular expression for a postal code in Poland. And it just gives you it. You don't have to go off to regexlib.com and copy it and paste it. And CLDR has that, along with a barrage of other information. And that's led me more recently to say, we as .NET developers need CLDR, because our own support in the .NET framework doesn't have the same scope as CLDR. So what I've been working on recently is something called NCLDR, which is a .NET port of CLDR, so that we can get all this goodness.
Brilliant. So that'll be something that you would make available for .NET programmers to get the CLDR.
Yeah, it'll probably go up on GitHub and be open source or something like that.
Well, that sounds extremely useful. You were in the middle of differentiating between globalization, internationalization, and localization. And I want to bring you back to that for a moment.
Yeah, sorry, I went off down my tangent. So localization is the adaptation of your program so that the resources, and by that primarily we mean strings, but not limited to strings, so it could be images or any other kind of media, such that they are not hardwired and they are replaceable via some means. So typically that would be all the strings in your application. Anything that the user sees in the user interface typically would be a localization issue. Now, there's a distinction I want to make here, in that when we make an application localizable, that's the work that we as developers do, then somebody else comes along, the localizer or the translator, and then they they translate it or they localize it. So they then convert your what are probably English resources into French or Swedish or whatever they're translating to. And then internationalization is the umbrella term for the entire process. And bear in mind, that's just the Microsoft world, which makes life exceptionally difficult when we talk to people outside the Microsoft world.
Now, let me ask you, my blog is universally American, and the only sop that I throw to internationalization is that I have taken to not abbreviating dates, but instead spelling them out.
So that, oh, great. So
there's no confusion. But is there more that realistically I should be doing with a small blog for my purposes?
Well, I think the date issue is the main issue, and I do personally spell out my dates. So long as you put a month name in there. In fact, most parsers will parse a date and recognize the fact that you've got a month name in there and work out wherever you put the other pieces, they can usually work it out. SQL Server's very good at that kind of thing. Nothing that particularly springs to mind, given that you're not writing an application. You're just publishing text for the rest of the world to consume, and providing you've got some decent blogging software that's using Unicode, then you're good.
And when you say decent software that uses Unicode, what advantage does that give me?
It means that you can write any Unicode code point that you need to represent. And so if you need to write characters which are outside the ASCII range, then they can be converted properly.
Yes, so when I was complaining about the cost of my trip to England, I could put in the pound sign.
Very good, excellent. Yes, indeed. And not the euro symbol, yeah.
Yes, and not the euro symbol.
See, I find problems like that really quite fascinating, because if you look at currencies, for example, in the .NET framework, you say, well, I'd like to format this Japanese yen. So we've got a number of yen, and we want to format that. So if you were to format that using a Japanese culture, it will format correctly with commas and decimal places and the yen symbol in the correct location, and it will be great. But the problem that we have there is, what if I, as an English person in the UK, wants to look at a figure of Japanese yen? Now, how do I format that? The problem with the .NET framework is it will say, well, I'm going to format this number using the currency for the current culture. What you actually want to do is you want to say, I want to format this for my culture using a different currency.
Yes.
So in France and Italy, the comma and the period are transposed. So a comma is a decimal separator. Well, if I want to look at euros, French euros, then I want to see it in the English formatting for the French currency. And again, the .NET framework solution to this is quite awkward. There are a number of ways of doing it, one being creating a custom culture, which is a bit laborious, and also subject to you having administrator rights. But CLDR will solve this problem in that you can take it apart and reconstitute it correctly for the given culture.
Now, how much of your work involves actual translation, word or phrase translation?
Personally, I don't do any, and I wouldn't do any. My languages extend to French, Spanish, Latin, and I truly want to give up at that point. My linguistic skills are fairly atrocious. For me, this is all down to a software engineering problem. So typically what I do is I use one of the machine translators which are out there. The Google Translate API is very good, but that costs. That stopped being free last December, I think. The Microsoft Bing translator has an API, and that's excellent. That's really very good. The uptime on that is superb. The speed is superb. The translations are relatively good for a machine translator, certainly one of the best out there. So that one's very good. Typically what I'll do is I've got tools which will say translate my entire application. So if I need a Greek version of my application, then I'll press a button and we get a Greek version of the application. But of course it's machine translated. And what we need to remember with machine translation is, if you were translating your application into Greek, then and you machine translated it, you look at the end result, you go, that's Greek. And it'll be Greek to you, Greek to me. And when, more importantly, when we show it to our boss and they look at it and they go, it's Greek. And that's great. None of us can read Greek. So it's all good. You ship it to the customer and they'll laugh because it'll be comical. The mistakes that machine translators make are regular. But it does a couple of things. It allows you to demo the software to people who can't speak the language. And that's great for Korean, for example, mm-hmm. because I don't speak Korean either. And it also allows you to say, well, for simple phrases, it's probably going to get it right. I will get maybe 50% of it right. And you've saved a whole load of translation costs. So I don't typically do any localizer or any translation myself.
There's a very old story about a senator who goes down to the U.S. Army where they're building the new computer, which takes up, you know, the entire building. So it gives you some idea when this was. And they were working on translation software. And the senator, they asked the senator for something to translate. And he said, out of sight, out of mind. And out popped two Chinese characters. And he said, well, I don't read Chinese. They said, no problem. We'll put it back in and get English. What came back was invisible idiot.
A great one.
But I think there's still some truth to it.
I love the translation for the message from Chinese into English, which is ended up being the server is not responding, which was not supposed to be the message that they were translating, but because they don't speak English, that's what they got. The other one I love was French DOS. If we cast your mind back that far. French DOS 1.0, I think it was. Do you remember the error message out of environment space?
Yes.
There you go. So that one got translated into French and then made it to release. And it wasn't until it got shown to French people, and it was the equivalent of there is no room in the garden.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Okay, we should stop doing machine translation.
Yes, indeed. Okay, on another note, moving back to internationalization, if I'm building an application, it seems daunting to me to lay the groundwork for internationalization. Should I build my application without regard to that and then hand it off to an expert such as you, or are there things that I should be doing as an application author that would make things easier?
Yeah, unfortunately, there are two answers to this. There is the internationalization answer, which is no, absolutely from the beginning. It needs to be internationalized. Finding the bugs later after you've gone down one particular route is extremely costly. And that's absolutely true. I'm a pragmatist, and I know from experience, everyone does internationalization in the version 2 of their product. The version 1 proves that they've got a market. And if you never get the products to market, then you haven't proven anything, and it doesn't matter if it's a great product. So with my pragmatist hat on, talking to the business, I know the business people won't sign off on internationalization on version 1. What I would recommend people do is, on version 1, have someone who knows internationalization, who's reviewing the application, who can stop you going down a path that isn't a good idea. And then when you say, okay, well, in phase 2, what are all the things that we cut out that we really wanted? And we could then go and do internationalization, and it does, I mean, it is a reasonable amount of work, and it does add complexity to the application, and then there's the maintenance of that complexity. The way I look at this problem is, let me digress for a moment. The solution to this problem for me is FXCop, and for me, FXCop is one of the most misunderstood tools that there is in the .NET world. I love FXCop, And I don't think really anyone really understands what it's useful for. So the FXCop static analysis engine, you run it across your application and it tells you what's wrong with it. And that's a wonderful concept. That's great. For most people, that's where it stops. You get FXCop with its several hundred rules, and they're the rules from Microsoft. And you run it and you get several thousand errors and you go, okay, we won't use this anymore. And you stop doing it. So there are two other ways to use FXCop, which I think are particularly useful. The first way, which is just simply almost the way FXCop was intended, which is you run FXCop with no rules at all. And then as you're doing code reviews and you discover an issue where you think, that's wrong. Let's turn on the FX cop rule, which refers to that issue. And now that issue will never come back again, and you'll spot it throughout the entire application. So you add back the rules incrementally. And when you're not faced with 4,000 errors in your application, you're faced with maybe 20, then you would fix 20 errors. You probably won't fix 4,000, though. You'll just bin it.
For me, I have to interrupt you. That's one of the greatest tips that I've had on this show yet.
I
mean, just how to use FXCop effectively. And you're absolutely right. That experience is you turn it on, you have all the rules on, and out comes this blizzard of errors.
Yeah. And everyone goes, well, okay, let's turn them all off again.
That's exactly right. But the idea of incrementally adding them for errors you have found that you want to make sure that now they're out, that becomes a very useful QA tool.
See, that's the bit that bugs me about code reviews, is you do the code review, and the first 2 or 3 weeks when you're doing code reviews, you find the same old problems over and over again. And that's why I love FXCop, is you go, right, let's eliminate that problem, because I don't want to discuss this in a code review ever again. And so we have an FXCop rule that stops that.
Yes.
The trick that I think people are missing with FXCop is writing your own FXCop rules. So the third way in which you can use FXCop is turn off all the rules, and in fact, don't use the rules that come from Microsoft. Not that I am disparaging those rules, they're very good. But here is another way of using FXCop. Just turn them all off, and as you're doing code reviews, so you write FXCop rules, which identify those problems, and then those problems will never come back again. Now, I like that approach because when I do a code review, I want my brain to be used. I don't want to have to say for the 6 months in a row, by the way, we did tell you in the last 3 code reviews not to write code that way. And then in 6 months' time, I'm going to have to say the same thing all over again. I want an FXCop rule that says, I told you not to do this, and actually you can't check in the code that does that anymore because you'll fail the build. Which brings me to, sorry, that was my little, I digressed for a moment, which brings me to internationalization. So I've done this for my field, my field being internationalization. I've written, I forget what it is now, 15, 20 odd internationalization rules. And you can't expect people to know this subject because for most people, it's outside the normal skill set for regular developers. And to expect them to learn this barrage of stuff is probably, it's not their primary job. So I think the benefit of FXCop is I write my library of rules that say, I know for whatever reason you mustn't do this. And let's take an example of when you construct a culture info object, you should not construct it using a locale ID, a number. You should construct it using a culture string. Now, it's not particularly important why that's true. What's important is I know that that is true and that is important, and I write an FXCop rule that says, don't do this. You can't check in code if you've done that because for whatever reason that you don't need to know about, that's a bad thing to do. And that's where I think FXCop should be used. You get people who are experts in certain subjects, maybe security or how to handle XML properly, or whatever rules they've come up with. You dump their knowledge in an FXCop library, and now, sorry to make them redundant, but you don't need them anymore. It's like having an expert sitting over your shoulder the whole time going, I know about internationalization, and I'm going to stop you from doing something silly.
Yes.
Another classic example there is concatenation. So I think that many people are aware that when you localize, you mustn't concatenate strings. You can't build up sentences by saying, take this word, add it to this word, add it to this word, and then display it to the user. Apart from the fact that word order is different in different languages, the context of each word changes according to how you're using it. Certainly in terms of plurals and genders, the rules for plurals and genders are not the same in other languages as they are for English. So you can't build up concatenated strings and then slap the final string at the end user. So one of my FXCop rules spots you retrieving resources and then concatenating them with other strings, because that will not work in certain cultures.
So let me ask you a provocative question, which is I absolutely see why if you're building your program in Bulgaria, you're going to want to internationalize it, at least so that it succeeds in an English-speaking audience, because that's where your market is. And if you're building an application in Greece or Russia, you may very well want additional languages. But just to play devil's advocate for the moment, in commercial aviation, everyone speaks English. A Russian pilot talking to a Russian tower speaks English.
Yeah.
So why is internationalization not at least partially solved by saying that we have a lingua franca? Amusingly, the French language is English. and what internationalization will consist of is making it work in the original language and English, and Bob's your uncle.
For me, it depends who your consumers are. And in your example, they're consumers who are speaking English anyway, so the problem does go away, and you need a standard anyway. But I think the problems increase the more you need to demonstrate that you understand the people that you're working with. So if we talk about a line of business application, which is written in one department and then sent throughout the world, but it's still an internal only application, then the requirement for you to appreciate the user's culture is not as high as it would be if you're writing a social networking site. If you're writing a social networking site, you must be on a personal basis with those users, and you must localize to them. Otherwise, your company loses image, and it will lose faith, and they won't use it. And the example I tend to give is, you know how when you're on a shopping site, you say, you have three items in your basket?
Yes.
That seems like a really simple sentence. And it is for English. So the first attempt that people will make at that is, you might say, well, let's just have one string. And you'll say, you have, and then some parameter which you'll pass in, and then item, open round bracket, S, close round bracket, in your basket, because you don't know whether that is singular or plural.
Right.
That'll be most people's first attempt at solving that problem, which is an English, I mean, that's an English grammar attempt at solving that problem. An English person may say, no, we happen to know that if we want to do this properly, we need singular and plural. And they go, right, we'll have one string for there is one item in your basket, and another string for there are, and then many items in your basket. And now it will look right, whereas before it was still right, but you had to work out, well, you look at it and go, well, the developer is a bit lazy, really.
Right.
And that works for English grammar. And it doesn't work for half of the other countries in the world. The pluralization rules from country to country are much more, ours is the second simplest pluralization system on the planet, with Japanese being the most simple system where they don't have plural forms. In written form, there are no plural forms in Japanese. But if you go to Polish, for example, there are four or five different plural forms. So you have one for zero, one for one, one for two, three, four, and then a different one after that. And then you have to work out, okay, well, this is a modulus of 11, but not for the values 12, 13, and 14.
No, come on. You're making that up.
I am not making this up. I swear I'm not. And you get the same thing in Hungarian, Russian, Arabic has six different rules for pluralization. So the question there is, who is our customer, and how well do we need to tell them that we understand their world? If you're writing a social networking site, you would say, I need to talk to you on a personal basis. This needs to be, so another example I haven't talked about here is gender. If it is my basket is dependent upon, am I male or am I female? And it's, you can, as an English developer, you could say their basket and just avoid the problem. But you don't look like you understand the culture properly. You look like you were avoiding the problem. So the question for me is, who is the consumer and what kind of image do you want to give? Do you want the consumer to have a solution that they would think they have not had their language fitted into an English appreciation of grammar?
Well, I have to say, you told me that this was a boring topic, and I'm totally enthralled.
I love this subject.
And how do you solve the English problem of masculine and feminine? It's in his basket, her basket, their basket.
So, firstly, what you need is you need the data that that makes those kind of decisions. So you need to know, is a person masculine or feminine, or do we either not know, or they don't want to reveal that? So there are three, for the case of gender, there are three cases.
Or it's mixed.
Or it may be mixed, so we're talking about many people. Actually, the rules for that are quite fascinating, because if your list includes Bob, Sue, and Mary, in some cultures, that's a masculine list. But in other cultures, that's a neuter list. Mm. And you need, isn't this great? The world's a big place.
And in our culture, it's a masculine list, but there's a political overlay that says it shouldn't be.
Indeed. So that's an interesting problem. And for that particular case of gender, you could solve it by saying, let's have three localizations for a particular string, a masculine, mm-hmm. a feminine, and a neuter, or an unknown. But unfortunately, it's not going to go very far. That will run out of steam fairly quickly, because the moment you have more than one piece of data there, so if you say, I sent three emails to my friends, now you've got two parameters. There's the gender of my friends, and then there is a parameter of three, which is being passed in. So you have to solve two problems simultaneously. Your plural problem and the gender problem need to be solved at the same time, because you can imagine there, let's say you've got six different plural rules for Arabic, and you've got three different genders. So what would you have? Would you have 18 localizations of that string? At that point, you go, no. We're not going to have our translators sit there and translating one string 18 times. You need a grammar parser of some kind, which will say, okay, these are the pieces that I'm going to slot in and slot out. Whereas I did say you must not concatenate strings when you're building them up for languages. It is acceptable to concatenate them within your known language, given that the concatenation is being done based upon a particular grammar set for one language. So it would be acceptable for localization. In that case, what I'd do is I'd have one string which understood all six cases of pluralization and all three cases of gender.
So I'm going to switch subjects on you slightly, which is, do you think it's a coincidence that you specialize in internationalization and that you're in the UK, as opposed to being in the United States, where we are more provincial and think less about the rest of the world?
I don't know. If you ask anyone on continental Europe, they will tell you the British are monolingual. And that's a fair criticism. We aren't quite monolingual. We get taught French in school and German and Spanish. And I learned Latin when I was at school, and that's fairly, I mean, there's a useless language. But I don't know the answer to that. I got involved in it a very long time ago, originally back in the days of Clipper. You remember Clipper?
I do.
There you go, Clipper, and then...
You are old.
Yeah, hey, you and me both. Don't you find, sorry, just to go off at a tangent here, don't you find that fascinating in that the old ideas continually get reinvented, so... When you and I started programming, interpreted languages were almost the only languages which are out there, with the exception of assembler and C++ and writing raw machine code. At that point, they were all interpreted languages. And then we moved forwards, and nearly all languages became either truly compiled or compiled to intermediate language.
Yes.
And now we come back to Python and Ruby and other languages which are dynamic in their nature.
And JavaScript, God help us.
Indeed. We had support for dynamic types back in the 80s. In fact, we only had support for dynamic types back in the 80s.
Yes.
We had no strong typing. And they become popular again 30-odd years later. I find that fascinating.
Lisp has conquered the earth.
Okay. Moving on.
On that note... Well, Guy, this has been a fascinating tour, and I know that we've only scratched the surface on internationalization. Before I let you go, I did want to ask you, I know you're involved with some of the user groups in the UK and connected to many of the user groups in the UK, and is that still a thriving community. Certainly was my impression that it's a very thriving community of user groups for .NET.
It does look like it. In some ways, difficult to compare, but it does look alive and very active. In the UK, we have the equivalent to the US code camps in the form of an event called DDD, which is thanks to Steve Ballmer. I don't know if you do you remember the speech where he was walking around the stage going, "Developer, developer, developer, developer." You remember that one?
Yeah. So, Frosty.
Yeah, indeed. And a guy in the UK, Craig Murphy, was inspired by this and started our range of code camps, which are called Developer, 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 which gets such a mouthful to say that it's called DDD. And he did a count up recently. There have been 30 of them in the last, I forget what it is, 5 years or so, which was an idea which has gone around the various countries in our world. So England, Scotland, Ireland, and now Australia. There have been quite a few in Australia. So
that's an exceptional number given the population numbers. That's an extraordinary number.
Yes. And we get an advantage that that you guys don't, which is our landmass is very compact. And I find that bizarre in that in the US, many people will take it an hour or hour and a half's drive to go to a user group event. And in the UK, people are reluctant to travel 30 miles to go to a user group event. So they are somewhat siloed, but there are a lot of them in the UK. What have we got now? So the London.NET user group, I think, was the oldest, and that came out, I think it was shortly before the release of .NET 1.0, so that's a very venerable user group. Yeah.
So I have to interrupt and tell you that I owe them an apology. I was to speak with them, and I got called out to DevReach this year. But that is my excuse for coming back to the UK, that I owe London.
Okay, you have to come back. So can I ask you a question then?
Yes, please.
You've done two tours of the UK now. I'd be fascinated to know, what were the differences? What were the things that you thought, well, that's a nice idea that we don't do in the US? Or what are the tricks that we're missing? Where are we missing an opportunity here?
Beer. You have beer at your meeting. That's clearly the number one standout difference. Is most U.S. meetings, you have the meeting and then you go out to the pub afterwards. But bringing the pub into the meeting is an extraordinarily excellent idea.
I've got to say that's only a few inspired user groups in the UK. In Liverpool, I think, but in Scotland, it is a wonderful idea. Yeah, I wish we could do that too.
Aside from that, I would say that the biggest difference that I noticed is that all user groups have a certain reluctance, at least initially, to interact with the speaker or to interrupt or to ask questions. But I think, frankly, the British are a bit more reserved.
Yeah.
I know that's the stereotype, but it seems to be true. That
no, I would completely agree with that.
And so as a speaker, I mean, I really thrive on the feedback, and sometimes, you know, it's very hard to tell how you're doing or whether people are engaged in the UK because they are a bit more reserved. You do get a higher per capita turnout, I think, than we get. That is to say, if you take an area, you take the general population number of that area and then see how many people show up to the user group, you get a larger number.
Maybe it's just you.
Well, that's a nice thought. I like that. But then again, I'm speaking here as well, and, you know, four people show up, so I don't know.
or is that a case of you're appreciated more in the places where you don't live?
Well, that's possible. So I should spend more time overseas.
Indeed.
Excellent idea. I have been told that the overseas audiences tend to be harder on speakers. I don't know that that applies to the UK.
I think that does. I must admit, I like the audience here, but I find when I speak in the US, it is such a delight to have such an appreciative audience. And you go, you guys are really up for this. And for an English guy, I go, hey, I'm not quite used to that.
Yes. Well, there's much to be said for both. I'm a hopeless Anglophile and will come to the UK at the drop of a hat because I just enjoy being in the country. I enjoy the people. I enjoy the differences in our languages and the small cultural differences. I just think it's all very fascinating.
And it would be great to have you back.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. And we'll and you'll have to let us know when you're in the States so that we can come in here more about internationalization in depth.
The trick is getting me to shut up.
Yes, I often say that. The hard part is not getting me started. It's getting me stopped. Indeed. Well, Guy, I can't thank you enough for doing this. This was terrific.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks very much for asking me.